cured me of ignoring this thing.
Welcome to my house.
Stop!
Okay. I hear you there, bud.
We don't believe it.
All right, this is the 10th of November. We're going to be starting a new study. We're calling it the Post-Exilic History of Israel. It's a summation, a review of the history of Israel following the Babylonian captivity, and it includes six different Old Testament books that we'll be looking at: Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, and we'll see where all of those people played their roles in Israel's history as we go through this review. Now, this chart is probably the best one I have to review Israel's history. It's not perfect, but it ain't terrible. We'll look at it for a little bit. How did the nation Israel begin? Who or where and when did Israel actually begin as a people? Ever heard of this guy named Abraham?
Abraham, yeah.
Yeah, Abraham was the beginning of the nation Israel, wasn't it? Where was he living at the time God called him and said, I got a job for you here, bud? Where was he at? He was in... I beg your pardon? Yeah. Kind of what is today modern-day Iraq. Ur of the Chaldees was a city down there in the Mesopotamian Valley, Tigris-Euphrates Valley. And God called him to do something about 2,000 years after creation. If you try to summarize all of biblical history, it falls into three groups of 2,000 years each. From creation to Abraham is 2,000 years. From Abraham to Christ, 2,000 years. From Christ to today, 2,000 years. 6,000 years of biblical history, and that's all we get. If you take scriptures literally, you don't get those 6 million, 6 billion years of age and all that nonsense. You get 6,000 years, and 2,000 of it was from the creation time frame down to Abraham. God called him when he was living with his idolatrous family. Why does God pick an idolatrous to start this program of calling Israel, I wonder? Well, yeah, what else is he going to do? Somebody's going to have a big dent in them somewhere. That's right. But Abraham did believe him, and he came finally. He got there, a little bit of a hiccup on the way, but he got there into what is today Palestine. And so his descendancy then began his descendancy through a certain line of descent began the nation Israel. Abraham had more than one child. And so the descendancy follows down through one of the two primary children that he had at first. And so they began as a family. And they ended up getting between a rock and a hard place after a while, and there's all kinds of stuff that could go in between there, but we don't need to worry about that with what we're doing. But he began as a family of about how many people that ended up going down to Egypt to try to live because they had some grains and so on? How many went down there? Remember the number? Yeah, about 70 of them. 70 family members. That's how the nation Israel began. It began as a family of 70. And they were down there some, roughly 430 years. Not all of that may have been in Egypt, but there's some debate about exactly how to number that. But let's just stay with that, and we'll say they were down there about 400 years or so. And the Egyptians were kind of abusing them, so to speak, using them for slaves and that kind of thing. And so they were between a rock and a hard place, and God brought them out of there at what we call the Exodus, which took place in about 1440-ish, 1446 or something like that. And he brought them out of there. How many were there? How big did that family get in that 430 years or so? Remember? 600,000 men. So what, maybe 2.5 million people? Four people per family, say? I don't know. The only number we know for sure is the 600,000 men. So they're a nation of about, or a family of people of about 2 to 2.5 million people when they came out of that place, some say 400 years or so afterwards at the Exodus here. That's a pretty good-sized group of people to hike around the world, isn't it? To start moving around as a group, staying together. I mean, good grief. How do you feed that many people? How do you water that many people? How do you take care of 2.5 million people on a daily basis of having to have something to eat and all that? Well, the book of Exodus and some of the other Torah books explain all that. They got pretty fond of birds for a while, and God put something on the ground. They didn't know what it was, so they called it, what is that? Manna. So he provided stuff for them, and they were all taken care of, and everything worked okay, and they wandered around for a while, and that first generation that came out of there turned out to be some real duds, and they never got in. 40 years they wandered around until their shoes fell off their feet. Actually, they didn't wear off at all. And that first generation all died off, and then following generations got to enter the promised land, but the first generation did not. Why? What happened? Well, they sent some spies into Palestine, Israel did, to check the place out, and when the spies came back, there was 12 of them, 10 of those spies said, we can't take the place, even though God had said, I'm going to give it to you. And so God said, all right, you ain't going in then. So 10 of those 12 didn't make it into the promised land, but two of them did, Caleb and Joshua. And so they entered the promised land under Joshua's leadership and began to take the place. And that went on for about another 50, 55 years or so. And in the rest of the history, we kind of pick up in the time of the judges. They wanted a king all the time of the judges. They kept begging God for a king because the people around them had a king, so they wanted one. But he wanted to be their king, and he would rule over them in judges. And there was 12 cycles of judges that he had to raise up. They would get beat down by somebody. God would raise up a judge. The judge would lead them in victory, and they would settle back down and worship God. And that went on for 12 cycles. 300 years of judges, positive, negative, judges, positive, negative, 13 judges, 12, 13 judges. They finally gave him a king. And the first one they gave him was a guy named Saul. And he reigned over them for about 40 years. But the guy he really wanted and eventually got into that role was a guy named David. Now, David was about as good of a military guy as you would find anywhere. That's one guy you do not mess with. And so he built the nation in those early days into, and I'll show you a picture of it here. Everything you see here in blue is essentially what David conquered for Israel. All of that was the nation Israel's territory and influence during the reign of David. David was the man. If you mess with him, you did so at your own peril. And some people did, but they shouldn't have. So during that particular time frame, the time of the kings, David in particular, the nation grew largely as a result of his military prowess. Now, at that point in time, they didn't have a symbol of their national identity, like a worship center called a temple. They had the tabernacle that they built back during the Exodus days and drug it around with them everywhere up until about this time. When David came on the scene, he wanted to build a temple for God, a house for God. And God said, nah, no can do, David. You are a military guy. You got blood all over you. You're not going to build my house. Your son's going to build my house. Solomon, David's son Solomon, who ruled after him, God said to Solomon, I want you to build me a house. And he did. He built this temple, and it became the national symbol of Israel, kind of like the White House is for us today. I got a picture of it somewhere and all this stuff. Yeah, here's a little schematic of the one Solomon built. This was their first one. This was their first temple. Now, they had the worship center in the tabernacle, you know, and they drug it around for a number of years. But this is the first one of the actual temples, and it looked about like that. Had this outer wall around it, but here's the actual place where God dwelt, was in here. He would be back here. He dwelt right over this thing here. So this part here is the temple proper, and this part back here is actually where God was. You had certain things out in this area and certain things back here where he was. The Ark of the Covenant was back here, and that's where God was, and that's where he would dwell before them. So that's the first thing the first one that they had. As you can see, the inner part is what maybe, I think they said it was like 90 by 30 is the dimensions of this part here. Okay, this part here. Then the outer part was bigger, but that's kind of in addition to the main part. So Solomon builds this thing, and this becomes then kind of their symbol of national existence. And they rocked along like that for a while. And then Solomon died off, and his son stepped in the picture. And he was a kind of foolish guy. He kind of was oppressive to the Jewish people. And they didn't all like him. And there's 12 tribes, and they're all living in that area I was just showing you there a while ago. And 10 of those 12 tribes said, Solomon, we don't like your son. We're not going to follow him. His name was Rehoboam. And they said, we're going to get our own guy. And us 10 tribes in the north of Israel, we're going to team up together under our guy. His name was Jeroboam. And we ain't going to follow you. And the other two tribes in the south, which was Judah and Benjamin, they said, no, we're staying with David's line of descent. And we're not going to follow you. So the kingdom split between a northern and a southern kingdom. And it then looked like this. The green at the bottom is the southern kingdom. It was called Judah, two tribes, Judah and Benjamin. And the orange at the top is the northern kingdom called Israel, the remaining 10 tribes. So this is what Israel looked like following the divided kingdom of Solomon's descendants. 20 kings ruled over these people here, and not one of them was a godly man. 20 kings ruled over these people down here over the next number of years. And two or three of them were, but the rest of them weren't godly men either. The period of the kingdoms in Israel's history was not a particularly positive one. The nation degenerated rapidly. They deteriorated rapidly. Not good. And God kept telling them through the prophets and so on that, guys, I ain't happy with the way you're behaving there. And if you don't straighten up and fly right, I'm going to send some big meanies down there and stomp on you. You guys here in the Northern Kingdom, which went on for 209 years, you're doing bad. And I'm going to send somebody to punish you for doing bad. And that somebody he decided to send was what? Do you remember who that was? They were the Assyrians. The Assyrians were a nation that became a world power. And this, let's see, maybe we can get one layer of darkness out of there. Is that any better? Not much. But the Assyrian Empire went all the way from Egypt up here into this territory up here and almost as far over as India. All of this was the Assyrian Empire. And Israel is, can't even read it from where I am, but they're kind of right along here, you know, about that much right there. And the rest of that is the Assyrians. And God said, if you don't put those idols aside, if you don't come back to worship and being proper, I'm going to send these guys to punish you. And he did. They did not respond well. And so God sent the Assyrians into Israel's history, and the Assyrians took the northern 10 tribes and carried them away into Assyrian captivity. That's why that arrow ends there, 722. 722 BC, 209 years later, the Assyrians came in here and destroyed the north, took the northern 10 tribes captive and carried them off. Replanted back a mixture of Assyrians and Jewish peoples who intermarried together, and so you got this whole development of a half-breed, a hybrid people, Gentile and Jews that have co-married together, known as the Samaritans. Well, how did the Jews, the purebred Jews that weren't carried off and intermarried with them, how did they think of those guys? They hated them, didn't they? Yeah, the Jews hated the Assyrians, Samaria, an area up there. Remember when the Lord talked to the woman at the well up there from Samaria? She had a whole different theology than what the Jews in the south had. She thought they ought to be worshiping up there, Mount Gerizim and all this nonsense. They were a different people. So the northern 10 ended at 722. The southern 2 are continuing to truck along. They've still got their temple down here. They've still got a symbol of national worship and so on. So they continued to survive longer. They lasted about 345 years. Every king in the south was of Davidic descent. Every one of those guys in the southern kingdoms could trace their ancestry to David. None of them in the northern kingdom could. All of them in the southern kingdom could and did. But they too fell into idolatry and just terrible living and so on. And God kept warning them that if they didn't straighten up, he was going to do the same thing to them as he did to the northern kingdom. He was just going to use a different hammer. This hammer was going to be named Babylon. And they were told it was going to happen. Who told them that? Who was their mouthpiece that told them, hey, guys, this ain't a good path that you're on here?
Jeremiah,
absolutely. Jeremiah chapter 25. The message came to them loud and clear. They should have known what awaited them. Let me just give you a few quotes in chapter 25. The Lord says on verse 3, from the 13th year of Josiah, son of Ammon, king of Judah, even to this day, these 23 years the word of the Lord has come to me, and I have spoken to you again and again, but you have not listened. Verse 4, the Lord has sent to you all his servants, the prophets, again and again, but you have not listened. Verse 7, you have not listened to me. Verse 8, Jeremiah 25. Therefore, thus says the Lord of hosts, because you have not obeyed my words, I am going to stomp on you. Verse 12, then it will be when 70 years are completed. Well, let me get verse 11 first. And this whole land shall be a desolation and a horror, and these nations shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. So God told them through the prophet Jeremiah that if they didn't fix this, they're going to be taken captive by and have to serve Babylon for 70 years. They were told that ahead of time. They knew that. And remember Daniel. And Daniel chapter 9 says, when I woke up one day and I realized that that 70 years that Jeremiah said was going to be our time of captivity down there, that was about over. So he started praying that the Babylonian captivity would come to an end, and it did. But for 70 years, and this is the book of Daniel's right in through here, they're captive down here. So this kingdom disappears, and their temple is destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar right here for 70 years. So now, there is no identity of the nation Israel. They don't have a national symbol of their existence anymore because Nebuchadnezzar tore it down, destroyed it. I'll show you the Babylonian Empire. It's just kind of a subset of the middle of the Medo-Persian Empire. Okay, so now the Babylonian Empire has risen right into this area, kind of right where Abraham came from. It came from right down in here. So this is the big guy on the block now. This is the elephant in the room, and God used this nation to destroy the southern kingdom. Three times Nebuchadnezzar sieged Jerusalem, starting in 605, like 10 years later, and 10 years after that, in 586, he finally finished the place off. So it took him 20 years, but he finally finished the place off and carried those people off into captivity. So from that time forward, there is no nation Israel. Because any semblance of it is in Babylon for this 70 years or so. And when Daniel saw that this time was about to run its course, he said, God, cut us loose. Our 70 years is about up. Let us get out of here and go home. Well, how did that come about? You remember in Daniel chapter 5, the words meeny, meeny, tekel, upharsin mean anything to you? The handwriting on the wall? Remember that story? Nebuchadnezzar's son, who was kind of a loser, not kind of a loser, he was a loser. Belshazzar, king of Nebuchadnezzar's son, could be his grandson, the way they name him, you can't tell for sure. He held a great feast for 1,000 of his nobles, and he was drinking wine in the presence of the 1,000. The Medo-Persian Empire was right outside his door. He holds his feast, I think, to kind of puff his chest out and tell everybody how great and wonderful they are. In the midst of that feast, we get this handwriting on the wall thing took place. And that same night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean, the Babylonian, was slain so that Darius the Mede received the kingdom at about age of 62. So Babylon is now over and done. God has used the Medo-Persian Empire to judge the Babylonian Empire. So a bigger guy on the block came into play, and God used them to destroy them. That's when things kind of took a little bit of a turn for the better, because the Medo-Persian king, he was kindly disposed toward Israel. So this nothing of a nation now, which doesn't exist essentially, is about to get a little bit of a second chance to revive. So right here toward the end of the Babylonian Empire, when the Medo-Persian Empire took over the place, Israel has nothing. They aren't a nation. They don't have a national symbol like a temple or anything like that. They're kind of a non-existent nobody. Well, geez, that sounds like that needs to be helped. That needs to be picked up or something, doesn't it? And that's where their post-exilic history begins. At the beginning of the Medo-Persian Empire, the conclusion of the Babylonian Empire, right in through here, and this chart is not perfect for everything, but it's okay for what we're doing right now. But right in this time period here is when this transition is taking place, when Israel is going to get to go home. And that's where we pick up the book of Ezra. Ezra.
How many people alive even knew or remembered what Israel was?
Well, there's about 50,000 Jews down in Babylon that come back. They knew, the Jews knew. Probably nobody else cared much. I wouldn't think any of the Gentile nations would give a hoot.
They look at that map. I mean, just
yeah,
the whole
yeah,
region
that's right.
Is huge compared to
yeah, when you compare the geography of Palestine to the geography of the Medo-Persian Empire, they're just a speck. They're nothing. But their God's nothing. Yeah. Go ahead, Jack.
But there were people that were old enough, that were pretty old, okay, that came back, because when they rebuilt the temple, it was so pathetic compared to the Solomon temple, they wept. So that would be in Ezra.
We'll see all that in a little bit.
But yeah, so there were some people that remembered what Solomon's temple had looked like and how glorious it was. And while having a temple is better than none, it was certainly not as glorious as Solomon's was, and as later as Herod rebuilt it to be.
So, now remember, they've been down there 70 years. The people in the Babylonian captivity were there for 70 years. So even if they went down there as a youngster, let's say a 10-year-old, you're talking about 80-year-old people now. We'll talk more about that in just a minute. So find Ezra in your Bible, and let's pick the trail up on what happened. All of Israel's post-exilic history takes place right here in this time frame on this chart. Malachi might be a little bit outside it, but basically it's right in through here. So this period following this Babylonian exile, this is when they come back, and we'll see what happens to them when they do. Okay, you in Ezra? Did you find it? Okay. Then the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that's Medo-Persia. That's the guy that just threw the Babylonians out with the garbage and took over the Babylonian Empire. The Jews are now living under his leadership, Cyrus, king of Persia. In order to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, that prophecy I just read you a while ago, in order for that to come about, Jeremiah 25:12, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia. Well, now, wait a minute. This guy, this is the Persian king. This ain't a Jewish king. And the Lord stirred him up. Whoa, I'm thinking Daniel chapter 4 here. The Lord controls the affairs of men. He can stir up whoever he wants to, can't he? You don't have to be a godly servant to serve God. He can make you serve him anyway. So here we go. We get the king of Persia, the new kid on the block, the new sheriff in town over Israel. He now becomes kindly disposed toward them because of God's stirring of his spirit. So that he sent a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and put it in writing. And here's the proclamation that the Persian king makes in his first year of reigning over the Babylonian, over the Jewish captives. Thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, as you were just noting from those maps. And he has appointed me to build him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. So here's the Persian king saying, hey, God has given me a job, guys. And my job is to go into Judah and build him a temple. So the king of all of this stuff, he says, I'm going to go down here in Judah and build you a temple. What's the explanation for that kindness other than divine control, divine sovereignty? God's taking charge of the Jews' needs and wishes and wants. So the Persian king is the driver behind the rebuilding of the temple in Judah. Following so far? Following the history so far? Their enemies are helping them. And who, verse 3 of Ezra, chapter 1, whoever there is among you of all his people, that is, you Jews, may his God, that is, your God, Jewish God, be with him. Let whoever chooses go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and rebuild the house of the Lord and the God of Israel. He is the God who is in Jerusalem. Now, does his comments assure you one way or another of his belief? Is Cyrus speaking as a believer in this verse? Verses. What is the basis of salvation in all ages? Faith. Belief. All ages. Doesn't matter. Do you see any indication on the part of Cyrus that he actually believes God's word in any way? These are pretty good words. I'm optimistic that maybe, the guy was a believer. Nebuchadnezzar speaks similarly at times. And I'm optimistic that maybe he was a believer. But I don't know for sure. He never expresses a belief in God. Remember, Abraham counted God, and it was counted righteousness for him, Abraham. That's the prototype for all believers. You believe God, and your belief counts as righteousness. This guy doesn't say he believes. He just says, God gave me this job, and I'm going to do it. So if we're stumbling around in heaven one day and we bump into this guy, don't be surprised. If you don't bump into him, don't be surprised. We can't tell. We don't know. But he seems to be a little more pro-God, pro-Jew, than many leaders that we see in Scripture. So maybe there's a chance that this guy actually came to faith. I don't know. He doesn't say that. So we don't know. Any rate, whoever wants to go back can go back and build that temple. And every survivor at whatever place he may live throughout the whole Medo-Persian Empire, let the men of that place, that would be the Gentiles of that place, support him with silver and gold. Any Jew that wants to go back, you Gentiles living there with him, help him out. Get him some money together. Provide some support, materials, financial and otherwise, for the guy to go back. So he not only bakes them a cake, he frosts the thing for them. Tells them to help them out. Tells the Gentiles to help out these Jews to go back. Give them silver and gold and goods and cattle, together with a free will offering for the house of God, which is in Jerusalem. There's the funding for the temple, is that it's going to come from the Gentiles in the Medo-Persian Empire. Is that cool or what? Still, Pam driving down this morning, Democrats were $20 million in debt from their campaign, $20 million. Trump has offered to give them $20 million out of the RNC's excess to pay that debt off for the Democrats. Pretty kind gesture, huh? This is like that. This is a kind gesture on the part of this guy. You not only can go back, we'll help you to fund this thing. Us Medo-Persian types will support you in this endeavor and raise some money, and not only for you to get back, which is about a four-month journey, about 430 miles on a straight line, about 900 miles on a travel line, so take about 4 months to get back. So we'll support you to get back there and raise money for you to rebuild this temple, since you don't have one now, thanks to Nebuchadnezzar. Okay? Following along? So then the heads of the fathers' households of Judah and Benjamin, and these are the two tribes, remember the southern tribes were carried off to Babylon, the southern tribes were Judah and Benjamin, so the heads of the families, the Jewish families down there, and the priests and the Levites arose, everyone whose spirit God had stirred to go up to rebuild the house of the Lord, which is in Jerusalem. And all those about them encouraged them with articles of silver and gold and goods, with cattle and with valuables, aside from all that was given as a free will offering to build, rebuild the temple from. So people start raising money for these guys. And King Cyrus brought out the articles of the house of the Lord, which Nebuchadnezzar had carried away from Jerusalem and put in the house of his gods. Remember when Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the temple in 586, he took all of the utensils that were used in support of that temple, plates and cups and, you know, whatever, microwave ovens, whatever they had. And so Cyrus is giving them back. He's saying, take all this stuff that Nebuchadnezzar took from you and take it back with you. So he brought all that stuff out and he counted them out to somebody they're calling here Sheshbazzar. I think this is the same guy as Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel is the name you want to remember. Remember, Zerubbabel went back to clean up the rubble. That's how you remember that. So this guy is like the governor. They call him the Prince of Judah. He's like the governor of Judah in exile, so to speak. His name is one worth remembering, Zerubbabel. Now, this was their number. Here's the stuff they took back, a bunch of dishes and a bunch of stuff. You can look at those numbers. They don't mean nothing to me. And the articles of gold and silver numbered 5,400. So Sheshbazzar, or Zerubbabel, brought them all up with the exiles who went from Babylon to Jerusalem. So they bring back the stuff that Nebuchadnezzar had taken away from them. So how cool is this guy, Cyrus the Mede, or as he's sometimes called, Medo-Persian leader. He's sending them back, and he's sending them back with lots of resources to do this job that he thinks God called on him to do. So we've reached the end of the Babylonian captivity. The 70 years have transpired. The Medo-Persians have taken over dominance of the world and the Jews living in Jewish captivity, and he's going to let them come back. Go home, guys, and we will fund you to do that. How cool is that? Is that what you would expect from Israel's enemies? No, that's a divinely sanctioned activity. That's God at work. And this guy, the reason I hope he was a believer, because he seems like a nice guy. Kind to the Jews. What did God tell Abraham in Genesis chapter 12 would be the relationship between him and his enemies and him and his supporters? I will bless them that bless you, and I will curse them that curse you. Genesis chapter 12, the call of Abraham. The dumbest thing a nation can do in terms of its foreign policy is to become enemies with the Jews, because you're becoming enemies with God. The best thing you can do is to help the Jews, because you are helping God's program for them and mankind. And what's our foreign policy been? Anti-Semitism growing like a weed right now in this country, isn't it? Bad mistake. This guy is helping the Jews. He is standing in a place to be blessed by God. Yeah, we got to try to outrun the clock this morning, so I think we'll stop here and continue up next week. Are you following the history so far?
Sheshbazzar, you said we need to remember the other name.
Zerubbabel. Z-U-R-U-B-B-L-E. Or B-B-L-E. Anyway, she's showing it to you there. Okay. Zerubbabel. He's like the governor. And we're going to see another guy come on the scene. His name is Jeshua. Not Joshua, but Jeshua. He's the high priest. And those two guys are going to oversee the building of this temple. The governor, a political leader, and the high priest, a religious leader, and they will oversee the new temple that's going to be rebuilt. In Revelation chapter 11, there are two guys that are called my witnesses. Two guys. And the names that people use to guess who they are all over the place. I mean, Moses, a bunch of guys coming back from the dead and stuff like that. I don't think it has to be that exotic. I think it's the same two guys in their counterpart positions in Revelation 11, as we're seeing right here. We'll see the governor and the high priest will oversee the building of the temple here, and I think it's the same guys that will oversee the building of the temple in the tribulation period, Revelation chapter 11. Two plain guys here on earth, not dead guys that have come back or anything like that, but the governor and the high priest in the tribulation period will oversee the building of the temple then, I think. Go ahead, Jerry.
So, pretty much from 586, I guess, which could be like the last of the Jewish nation, 586 BC, until 1948, the Jews did not have a self-governed homeland?
They will reestablish national identity during the return here.
Okay, so in the temple, they did have their own self-governing.
The one that they rebuild?
Right, between 515 and 430.
Yeah, okay. They will come back to, we'll see that as we go along here. I'll show you the map of what they look like when they come back. So when they come back and reestablish themselves in Judah, they become, in effect, again, the nation again. And they're going to rebuild their temple to have that national symbol in place there.
But did they win anything, or was it just the person saying, you may do this?
It was just the person saying anything.
Okay.
God stirred up his heart, Ezra says. So God worked in the heart of Cyrus, the Persian leader, to make him come up with this plan that says, you Jews, you want to go home? Go home, and we'll help you. We'll fund you to get you there, however many of you want to go back, and it's going to end up being about 50,000 of them. All you guys that want to go back, we will fund your trip, and we will give you money to build that temple with. Maybe something on the order of about $90 million in today's dollars.
Well, but they were still basically, during that time, a province of Persia. They didn't have their own independent kingdom yet. They were reestablishing their Jewish identity with the temple, but they weren't self-governing at this point yet.
All nations that were under the Persian umbrella would be in that similar category. Yeah. You could claim a national identity and so on, but you had to pay taxes to them, and they could come in and wipe you out anytime they wanted to. That was true of the Babylonian era. That's true of the Persian, Medo-Persian Empire. And by the way, the Babylonian era began a time period called the Times of the Gentiles. From here, all the way down to Revelation chapter 19, when the Lord returns, is the time of the Gentiles. Gentiles are dominating the nation Israel. Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. All four in succession governed and ruled over the country of Israel. And will so until the Lord comes back. So during the tribulation period, the Antichrist will try to destroy Israel again. Of course, they have a national identity today, since 1948. But the Gentiles will continue to try to destroy them until Revelation 19. The Lord comes back, and we are with him. Okay, so we've just stuck our foot in the door. Any questions or comments about the history that gets us down to the time where they need to post? This is the exilic period. This is the post-exilic period that we're studying here. What happened after they got out of Babylon? And what's going to happen, we'll see as we go along. They got off to a good start. They got funded to go home. They got money to rebuild their temple. They can start to rebuild the place, the city, and all that, and we'll see all that before we're done, and start to live again as a nation after that Babylonian captivity. Everybody cool so far?
The kingdom of Israel that essentially then became conquered by Syria and then Samaritans, that's kind of just a dead end. Like, those people just got assimilated.
They kind of dissolved into a hybrid people.
Now, what date was that?
Beg your pardon?
What date was that?
722 is when the Assyrians carried them off. See, they didn't last as long as his ones in the south from the divided kingdom. Their 20 kings ran their course pretty quick. They were worthless. So they got down to 722, and God said, I've had about all I can stand, and he carried them into captivity, and they just disappeared. The guys in the south lasted longer, but they got carried off too.
They didn't totally disappear. They still existed at the time of Jesus.
What's that now?
The Samaritan people existed at the time of Jesus.
Well, they came back kind of right away. The Assyrians resettled them pretty quickly. So there was a people there, but the people there were not purebred Jews, and these guys couldn't stand them. So there's people there, but not an ethnically distinct people. They were a hybrid. Any other questions or comments before we hit the road?
Well, I just think that we need to understand that not every Jew returns.
No, we'll get into that.
Not everybody.
We're not there yet. Come back, and we'll see the number that did go back and all of that. So we'll see you next Sunday, Lord willing, and we'll keep on trucking. Yeah, Bob?
I have deep information. I had an app on my phone that I thought was a great Bible church app, and I was trying to get the lesson, and I worked hours trying to get it. So finally I went by the office, and they told me they weren't using that app anymore. And so I took off my phone, and they put another one on it, and now I can get the lessons. And I don't know. The stuff that I just tell you that they told me they canceled that app, and I asked them why, so they canceled that app, and I've got another app that's put on my phone. I get the lesson.
I didn't know that.
Did you hear Tom on the app? Well, the app I had.
So gracebiblechurch.org doesn't get you to a. I thought they told the congregation about that if they changed that app. Anyway, apparently not. Because I didn't know about it. And I'm part of the congregation. Small part. Insignificant part, but a part.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Got an old app I had.
You gonna wait for me at the end of the tunnel, or on this side, wherever? Where do you want to be? Just tell me so I know where to come. Okay, down right. Okay, the right side down at the main gate. Okay.